So welcome to another episode of a podcast that I've called Tales from the Battlefields by me, Terry Wenham. And this week we're going to do something different. It was back in 2014 that I became aware of an event that was being run by ABF, the Soldiers Charity, or what was known as the Army Benevolent Fund, called the Frontline Walk. And it was the first year that the walk had been put on because it was commemorating the centenary or beginning of World War One, the Great War. And it was something that grabbed my interest straight away. I'd long been thinking of ways in which I could make sense and do something meaningful to remember my great uncle that was killed on the Somme in 1916. And this seemed like the perfect opportunity to remember my great uncle Henry, but also raise money for the soldiers, veterans and their families of today. And I must say, it was probably one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life. Here we are 8 years later, and the walk has gone from strength to strength, and it's brought in over 400 people into the community of World War One and World War Two, and we've raised well over £1.4 million for the Soldiers Charity during that time. So in this podcast, it's really broken into two segments. In the first part, we'll be talking to two of the staff members at Soldiers Charity, Amy Kenyon and Steve Oates. And we'll also be talking to Steve Roberts, who many people will know is an experienced battlefield guide. He's been seen in quite a few television documentaries over the years. And Steve is our official historian for the walk. So we're going to start with an interview. And then after that, we'll have a chat with one of the walkers, Judith Tetlow. And Judith has got a very emotional story to tell about why she did the frontline walk and what it means to her. So without any further ado, let's get cracking and listen to what these people have got to say. So today I'm in central London at the headquarters of the Army Benevolent Fund, ABF, the Soldiers Charity. And I'm sitting in a room with people that I've known now for about 8 years. And we're going to be talking about the charity, but in particular the frontline walk that we've done every year since 2014, apart from 2020, was it? We couldn't do it. So first of all, let's find out who we've got in the room. Who are you, Steve?
I'm Steve Roberts. I'm one of the military historians who assist on the frontline walk.
Another Steve?
Yeah, two Steves today. So I'm Steve Oatley, and I work for ABF, the Soldiers Charity, in the events team.
And we've got Amy as well.
And I am an event manager, also at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, working with Steve on our various events.
Excellent. So, first of all, people tuning in, they've heard me talk about the Army Benevolent Fund, the ABF, before. But tell us more about the charity then, Steve. Where did the charity start from?
Yes, so we started as the Army Benevolent Fund in 1944. And we were set up initially by the government, by the cabinet. They wanted to make sure that the mistakes that were made at the end of the First World War weren't repeated at the end of the Second World War. So at the end of the First World War, grand promises were made about jobs for the boys and homes for heroes and a great welcome back after the Great War. And actually, a lot of those promises weren't met.
This is the land fit for heroes that we read about in the history books.
Exactly. And so as the Second World War was coming to an end, the government renewed its commitment to support veterans, and they set up the Army Benevolent Fund, the RAF Benevolent Fund, and support for the Royal Navy and Royal Marines. And since 1944, our role as a charity is to be there for every serving soldier, for every veteran, and for the family members who are also affected by the service of their partners or parents. So we act as a backstop, essentially, working very closely with the regiments and corps to make sure that any soldier, veteran or family member that needs help gets it and gets it quickly. So we do that in a couple of different ways. We fund individual grants through partner charities such as SAFA and the regiments and corps, but we also fund delivery charities. So we're often the biggest funder of the delivery charities that many people know, so Combat Stress, SAFA, blind veterans. A lot of these organisations, we provide big block grants to them every single year to enable them to focus more on their delivery rather than on raising funds.
So that's where the charity's acting as a sort of umbrella then, isn't it, to smaller charities? But even those charities are not that small, are they? But they're still reliant, they come to the ABF when they need help with specific projects.
Exactly. So we fund a mixture of core funding for charities, but also project funding. So last year, over the years, we support between 50 and 100 different military charities, all to make sure that they can deliver the support that they need to
their beneficiaries. And then there's the individual grants as well.
Yes, so the individual grants, again, the numbers vary year on year, but it's, I think in the last year, it was something like 67,000 people that we directly helped.
And they can be all over the world, not just in the UK?
Exactly. So if they've served in the British Army, or a family member of somebody that served in the British Army, the Soldiers Charity is there for them.
So we've got the youngest beneficiaries, just a couple of years old. I think the oldest was about 98 or something, wasn't it, the last set of figures that we saw. So
it is amazing that just the range of people we support, their backgrounds, their ages, it doesn't matter. If you've served in the British Army and you need help, we will be there for
you. And the charity's there. And so in 2014, someone had the bright idea of walking 100k across the First World War battlefields. And I think that, Amy, you may have been involved in that initial discussion back in those early days. Tell us about the frontline walk. How did it start? What was the point? What are the objectives?
So the First World War took place from 1914 to 1918. And 2014 saw the start of the centenary years, and being the Army's national charity and having quite a few veterans on our books, we wanted to do something to mark that, as well as commemorating the soldiers of the past while still supporting the soldiers and their families of today. I wasn't actually involved in the initial kind of discussions. That was our predecessors.
You were the first person that I spoke to.
Probably, yes.
I remember the phone call.
I joined the charity at like the young age of 24 with absolutely no idea what I was doing whatsoever. Handed this event.
Because you came from a corporate background.
Yeah, came from banking. Handed this event, which had, I think, 7 people signed up. And Steve took over as head of events that year as well. And we kind of sat down and we were like, we have this event that we have to deliver, and there's only 7 people signed up. What do we do? And kind of through hook and crook, we got 30 odd people, mostly staff, signed up that year, fundraising, Terry included. Terry was one of our early adopters.
Seems a long time ago now, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? And had a great time that year. It was a little kind of hit and miss. We made some of it up as we went along. But from that, developed this amazing event, which we initially only planned to take place for the 4 years of the centenary.
Yeah, during the centenary, yeah.
And it's just kind of kept going since then. So there's been about 600 people have taken part since then.
600 people have done the frontline walk?
618 in total.
Wow.
Not including the people who signed up for this year, obviously.
Yeah.
And raised just over 1.4 million.
1.4 million?
Yeah, since over it started. Those years. Which is just crazy for a relatively small number of people.
Yeah.
And every year, we have a fundraising target of £1,250, but every year people go above and beyond, and it's really inspirational. Just
so the 1,250 is what we're asking each individual to raise as a minimum to be able to do the walk.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But people really go above and beyond, and it's really lovely for us to see the kind of commitment to the charity and just how much people believe in it.
Yeah. And so, for those centenary years, we were just walking the World War One battlefields, but I understand the frontline walk has now picked up the Second World War battlefields as well. Tell us about Normandy. What's happened there?
Yeah, so for the centenary years, we just followed the kind of routes of interest for those 4 years. And as I said, we had planned that the walk would end in 2018. That would be one last big hurrah, but there was so much support and so much appetite to continue that we actually expanded. So we picked up on the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings, and created a route in Normandy. And that happened for the first time in 2019, and we had a lot of support from our existing audience, from the Frontline Walk group themselves, and quite a few new supporters who came on board for that year.
So who are these people that do the Frontline Walk? Are they all ex-soldiers, or are they civilians, or a mixture? What type of people signs up to do something as crazy as this?
They're honestly a real mixture. They're a lovely group of people. We've had, the youngest person was 18, the oldest was 82. They all have some kind of interest in the military or military history, whether they are serving themselves, whether they're a veteran, whether they're a civilian who's never served and just wants to support the Army's national charity while learning about World War One, World War Two. It really is, anyone and everyone can take part.
Broad brush, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how far is the walk in terms of kilometres or miles?
100 kilometres in 3 days.
Wow, 100 kilometres in 3 days.
People often underestimate quite how far it is, but it's about 20 miles a day, 35 kilometres a day, roughly.
It's not straightforward as that, though, is it?
It's not, absolutely not.
We were talking about this off-air, but having done this several times, it's not just the physical challenge, it's the mental challenge as well, going up and down hills. And when we did the 100 Days Offensive, we were walking across the pavé, as the French call it, isn't it, the cobblestones. So we got to experience what the BEF did in 1914, and it was harrowing, isn't it, at times.
Yeah, absolutely. And people have this misconception that northern France is flat. Can confirm it is absolutely not. There are some pretty nasty
hills there.
Especially
on the Somme.
Absolutely. But it is a real mental challenge as well as a physical challenge, getting up on that second day when you've already walked 20-odd miles and you just want to stay in bed.
And you know you've got another day at the
end
of that.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not selling this very well, are we?
But the feeling when you finish that 100 kilometres at the Menin Gate or at the British Normandy Memorial is just unmatched.
Mm, that's right. Yes, because what we tend to do on the frontline walk, on the Western Front one, is that on the final day we do the Ypres salient, starting up on the Passchendaele Ridge, and we walk through, for people that know Ypres, we walk through the Groat Market there, and we walk under the Menin Gate to the bridge on the far side. And as we do so, the charity staff then put the medals around our necks, and everyone's emotions then give way, don't they? And it's a moment that people that have done it, the 500-odd people that have done that particular walk, that they'll never forget. And as you said, a number of people have done it more than once, haven't they? Done it several times. Some people, I seem to recall, have done both the Frontline Walk, Western Front, and then the following week they've done Normandy or ran the other way, haven't they?
Yeah, we've had a few who have... I just think it's an incredible feat, really.
Literally feet in their case.
Literally feet, yeah. But we're walking under the Menin Gate. Out of all of the kind of event finishes that we've seen, we've experienced over the years, that and the British Normandy Memorial, there's just no comparison, really. It's just...
Because that's where we'll be ending this year, on the Normandy Walk, D-Day Walk.
Yes.
We're going to end day three under the relatively new Normandy Memorial, which is a spectacular sight overlooking Gold Beach.
Yeah, it will be a brilliant end.
Mm. What's been the highlight for over all these years then? I know you're passing on responsibility this year, aren't you, Amy? You're moving on to another project within the charity. But over the years, what can you think of a particular highlight?
For me, there have been quite a few highlights. I think I say this every year, but my favourite point on any of the walks is the start of day two, which is the German cemetery.
And it's dark, isn't
it? It's dark, yeah. And there's something like 44,000 people buried.
What's the name of that German cemetery, Steve?
Nivelsangas.
Yeah, near on the foot of Vimy Ridge, really.
Yeah, and you just get a real sense of the scale of World War One. You just walk through this gate into the cemetery, and you just see all these German crosses everywhere you can see. Like, you can't see the end of it, and it just really hits home quite how many people did die on both sides, the British and the German sides. And you get there and it's dark and you see sunrise there, and it's just a really poignant moment, worth getting out of bed for that day.
It is, and I remember one year we were there, and I can't remember who it was now, I'll have to remember later when it's too late, but somebody was sobbing, and one of the ladies was sobbing in front of the headstones. And I asked her, I said, what's going through your mind? What are you thinking? She said, well, my son's just joined the British Army. And she said, I'm looking at these headstones and these lads are the same age as him. And I'm thinking that although they were the enemy, these were all someone's son, brother, and all the rest of it. And that thought was with me for most of that day, actually, as we trudged along, because that is the particularly hard day, that day too, as we go up Vimy Ridge. That's a good point, actually. So when we look at the history, look at the Western Front, we've got 3 days that we do the walk on. Steve Roberts is here, a military historian, and Steve, at various points during each of these days, during the breaks, at the beginning of the day and at the end, will talk about the general history. So tell us about the Somme. Where do we go on the Somme battlefield, on the frontline war? Well,
the whole idea of the Somme, it tends to focus really around the central day of the battle. It's on the 1st of July, with a little sort of branches off every now and again into some of the later stages of the battle. But we start at the iconic location of the Loch Na Garr crater, exploded on 728 on the 1st of July, 60 tonnes of explosives that creates a very large hole in the ground. And it's that early morning sunrise and the walk starts there. Then they'll move off, they'll go through several locations during the course of the day, just ticking off some of them. We walk through parts of Mamet's Wood, extremely important to people of Welsh descent, but important to everybody. It's an iconic location. Morning breaks taken to the place called Flatiron Copse, where there are 2,500 soldiers buried in the cemetery there.
We've got several sets of brothers in there.
Yeah, there are three sets of twins, the Phillips, the Hardwicks, and the Trevelyans are there. But there's also a VC winner buried in Flatiron Copse, a guy called Edwin Dwyer, who'd won his VC in 1915, and he's one of those ones where I think it's, from my perspective, it's quite nice because I can actually play audio of his voice while standing at his grave.
I must admit, like when he did that last year or the year before, whenever it was, I've been to Flatiron Copse many times, I've been to his grave many times, but to hear his voice through a speaker booming out and then singing that song, it's something that does stick with you, isn't it?
It certainly is. And, it's one of those ones where you realise that, he's the only VC recorded during the First World War. So it's a fantastic...
And his story was that he won the Victoria Cross at Hill 60?
He's at Hill 60, which on the first couple of years, the frontline walk went through. So you had that transition from the Somme back up to Ypres on day three. The last 2 years we've moved the route so we don't actually go past Hill 60 anymore. But it's still the fact that you can, it's not very often that you can get to play a veteran's voice.
And his story is that he was standing on the parapet chucking bombs at the Germans on Hill 60 for people that have been there. And then he's gone home, got involved in training soldiers, which is when he recorded the radio interview. And then he's come back and he's killed on the Somme in the summer of 1916.
That's correct, yeah. And there's also the voice of the Lord Mayor of London talking about, because Edwin Dwyer is like most soldiers, he doesn't want to talk about it.
And he's a bit of a rebel as well.
He is a bit of a rebel.
We like a rebel, don't we?
Well, yeah, now and again. But so having moved on, we go from Mamet's Wood, we'll wind our way across country, doing some of the sort of the latter stages of the battles of the Somme, until we finally reach Thiepval, the memorial at Thiepval, which is where we take lunch. And of course, we factor in time for people to go and look at the memorial, talk about the names, talk about the people that are there, before moving on. And it's at this point that we start to utilise some of the walkers as well. I mean, we've got a guy called Tom Saunders, who is from Northern Ireland, passionate about the history of the Ulster Division. And of course, the next stop that we go through is the Ulster Tower and the story of the Ulster Division and Thiepval Wood. So at that point, Tom normally takes the group and gives a presentation.
It's amazing, Tom is, because... many people will know Tom and he guides people from Belfast regularly over to the Somme battlefield. But to hear him standing there at the Ulster Tower talking about the VCs that were won on the 1st of July, to hear him talking about how they rushed across no man's land with that wonderful accent of his, it really does bring it home, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Tom is an incredible character. And his knowledge of the Ulster Division is second to none,
isn't it?
It's ideal. And then, of course, moving on from there, we'll drop down into the Yonk Valley, climb up the hill the other side, again, following the 1st of July route, in through Newfoundland Park. which is always quite nice. You know, we get the Canadian students to come out and try and applaud the walkers as they come through.
Mm.
But at the same time, taking into account the fact that the Newfoundland Regiment was absolutely decimated in that site on the 1st of July 1916.
And we walked past Danger Tree?
You walked past the Danger Tree, we passed the caribou, it's not a moose, it's a caribou, out the bottom of the park, past the Highland Division Memorial, and then round through the village of Beaumont Hamel, and then into what is to me one of the most special places on the Western Front, the Sunken Lane at Beaumont Hamel, which is one of those locations where we can put film, we can put audio.
We can see those guys looking at the camera, can't we, in the Sunken Lane?
It's a very, very special place. So we do a presentation there, and again, they get to hear the voice of a man who was there on the day. And that then allows us to continue on out of the Sunken Lane. We cross the Redan Ridge, we head off towards Sayre, and then on towards the finish line at a place called Hibberturn.
Now that's always a magical feeling when we go into that long straight. Again, there's lots of history in Hibberturn, it's where they formed up before they went off to Gomercourt. But I seem to recall everyone having a beer last year, and we ended up with alcohol-free lagers.
Yeah, unfortunately, those that got there before us
had drunk all the beer.
Yeah, drunk all, there was nothing left but alcohol-free, which
it was all right, though, wasn't it?
Quite the same.
So that's the end of day one.
Yep.
And then we're back on the coach and we go, where do we stay? What are the accommodation details then, Amy, on the frontline walk? Do we have to stay out on the battlefield in tents?
Oh, no, absolutely not. We wouldn't make it.
That was the original plan, wasn't it?
We've considered it for years. Every year we have a chat about it and we think, should we go back to the camping idea? But you'll be glad to hear, not yet. We stay in the Holiday Inn in Arras, which have just been great to us over the years.
Mm.
They let us kind of take over the hotel and we trudge in and everyone's a little bit weary. We take over the bar.
We do.
It's just a nice place.
And we all have a meal together, don't we?
We have a meal together.
And then we have a foot clinic.
There is a foot clinic.
What's a foot clinic?
It's really a bizarre occurrence. I saw it for
one
the first
of many
time.
Bizarre occurrences.
Absolutely. I saw it for the first time last year and people literally come down with their various blisters and
general ailments.
And this team of medics from Classic Challenge just get on with it and they deal with some of the most horrific blisters I've seen.
Because we've got paramedics, haven't we, with
us? We've got paramedics, we've got doctors. Because again, 100 kilometres, it's a long way and people underestimate the impact it will have on their body. And these medics, they patch people up, they send them on their way. And the next day they're walking, not quite, as
they're back on the road, aren't they?
They're back on the road, yes.
Yeah, because day two, as we mentioned, we start at the German cemetery and it's pitch black virtually when we arrive, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Dawn is just breaking as we leave. Tell us about day two. For me, day two is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, it is quite tough, both from a physical and from a mental point of view. And one of the issues, of course, is that, you know, for new walkers, all of the old walkers are telling them, oh, what about the hill and halfway through and, you know, before lunch. But the history of the site and of the area is fantastic. And the one thing that's really unusual about day two in comparison to all the other days of the frontline walk and the Normandy walk is that on the start of day two, you can see your morning break stop. You can see the lunch point and you can see the finish point.
So it's not far there.
It doesn't look it.
No.
But it's a circular route which takes you round. Mm. And what it does do is, having left the German cemetery, which, as Amy said earlier on, I mean, there's 44,833 burials in Nouvelle-Sauvace.
A lot of them in a mass grave.
8,000 are in a mass grave. Of that, 7,500 of them are unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you an idea of the type of fighting. It's also the largest German cemetery in France, cared for by the German equivalent of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So having started from there, you're then going to... We actually don't head towards the front line, although it's the front line walk. Technically, we go behind the front lines for the first few miles of day two.
Aren't we also going over the ground from the 1940 Battle of
Paris? We are, yeah. We're following the 1940 counterattack made by two of the Royal Tank Regiments and two battalions of the Durham Light Infantry from 151 Brigade against Rommel's Panzers in May of 1940. So you're actually,
back to Dunkirk.
You are physically following the route of that counterattack as you head around the city of Arras. But then you branch back round and then move across. You come in through a cemetery known as Equave, and then the hill, the first hill of the day starts as you climb up to the top of the old abbey of Mont-Saint-Éloi, which it has the remains of the two towers left. And from there, a fantastic view all the way back down to where you've just come from, and again across to your finish line at Vimy Ridge. So morning break is taken there, and then you go cross country, and it's up and down.
This is the one, isn't it? This is the
This is the one.
You know, that large hill that we go up through the forest.
Yeah, this is the last climb up to Notre Dame de Lorette, which is the French National Cemetery. And of course, what that reflects is the fact that the British don't actually arrive in this area until 1916. The French have been fighting here since 1914.
This is what I can't visualise when I'm doing it. You're going up through this beautiful wood. You can't see very much in front of you, and then you're thinking, well, hundreds of thousands of French soldiers in 1914-15 attacked up these very slopes.
Well, and this is the point that I try to, you know, sort of illustrate to the walkers, and it's very difficult to do that because, you know, they're focused on one foot in front of the other, climbing up the hill, up a narrow little path that's so steep that they put barriers on either side so you can pull yourself up. But of course, all you have to do is highlight to the walkers that the French soldiers of 1914 and 1915, when they climbed up this hill, there were Germans on the top trying to kill them, and they were doing it in full kit and equipment.
And then when we get to the top,
then you get to the top.
Our meal, which is usually a bit of pasta, actually, at this point.
Yeah, it's normally a hot meal.
But then what we find is evidence of the French sacrifice.
Yeah, you have the French National Cemetery there with there are 19,000 burials. With a further 16,000 burials in four mass grave pits. But the other one that really sort of strikes people here, it's always one to make sure they have time, is if you wander across to the far side of the cemetery, you have what's known as the Ring of Remembrance. It's a new memorial. It's only been there since about 2014. But it's a circular memorial, like a black ring with lettering in gold from A to Z, and it has the names on it of 537,000 men of all nationalities who died in the Nord-Pas-de-Calais region of France during the First World War. And I've never met anyone yet that hasn't found their name. So it's quite an imposing memorial, but it really brings it home.
And then we leave there and we go downhill, and then it's up to Vimy Ridge,
It's a drop down the hill, then it's running parallel with the motorway for a bit over the 1915, 16 and 17 battlefields. Then we turn left and it's the climb up,
which is spectacular.
Oh, it is. It's great.
Really spectacular. When you get to the top of Hill, what they call Hill 145, is that right?
Yeah.
145.
Yeah, the pinball.
We all then meet there at the end of day two, and we have a group photo, which is iconic, really, isn't it, in the history of the frontline walk. And then that's the end of day two, and that really is for everybody, all of us that have done it, one of the tough but most rewarding days, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do we lose some casualties along the way on the frontline walk to people?
We do lose a few, yes. We always say that it's not a race, it's a very personal challenge, and the key thing to remember is that we are doing it as a group, and what's most important is that you are able to walk across that finish line, you're able to do the last kind of mile or so together as a group, and if that means you need to stop at a point on day one or day two, then we would encourage that. We wait for everybody at each.
It's a team effort, isn't it?
It's absolutely a team effort, and we're only as fast as the slowest walker, and we will always go at that slowest walker's pace.
And when we stop at the breaks, the people that have been, and the line can be stretched out several miles, can't it? And we don't start again after a break. The first person doesn't leave until the last person is ready to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we always make sure the people at the back have a decent break before we start again. That's why we always say to people, there's no point rushing off.
No.
You might as well take your time.
Take your time, yeah.
Absorb the history, listen to what the historians are saying.
Yeah, it is important. So we go back to Arras for about evening, and then we wake up, and then we're up to Ypres then. What happens?
Yeah, but of course, the downside to that one is that travelling up to Ypres, in some ways it's a downside because it's an earlier start. Because we actually have to check out the hotel and travel to Ypres by coach, so it's about an hour and a half's journey. Some people quite like that. It means they get their heads down for a little bit. But of course, we then get up to Ypres and we start. Initially, we used to start at the German cemetery at Langemark, but with variations on the route, we've now revamped it. And the start line now, for day three, is at Vancouver Corner, the Canadian memorial to the first gas attacks of April 1915.
The brooding soldiers.
The brooding Canadian.
That's what went through my mind when we started. Again, it was dawn, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And all I could see was that Canadian soldier leaning on his rifle, looking down at us. Thinking,
but of course, we've still got a direct link to day two, because we finished day two at Vimy.
Canadians.
And the Canadians held a competition for the memorial at Vimy. The Vimy memorial was the winner of the competition, but the runner-up was...
Did the Vancouver.
At Vancouver Corner.
Oh, wow.
So you've got that link between the two again. Yeah. But moving off from there, we'll move down. We go past one of the Hertfordshire Regiment memorials. We go up past a windmill. And then moving through, we end up at Polkapel Military Cemetery, where first break stop is taken, but it also gives the guys the opportunity to walk around a cemetery which is, you know, 7,000 burials in there or somewhere
most
around that.
Unknown in
the majority are unknown. It's got a couple of unique ones. It's got a headstone which has a musical score as the epitaph. It's also got what's claimed to be the youngest casualty of the First World War buried in a military cemetery, John Condon.
14.
Who's claimed at 14. And from there, it's a slog through and a gradual climb. You don't. It's not one that you notice, but it's a gradual climb up the Passchendaele Ridge.
So this is what, in October and November 1917, what the Canadians and Australians were doing.
Yeah, pretty much following the Canadian route up towards Crest Farm and then on into Passchendaele itself.
That is, for people that haven't done it, it's beautiful there now. It's quiet and you can walk up there or cycle up there, whatever you want to do. But in October 1917, this was considered to be the worst experience any British or Commonwealth or even German soldier has ever experienced.
Yes, yeah. It's synonymous of what people think about the First World War. It's the mud, the blood, men sinking in mud. But again, October, normally the weather's okay for us, the ground's reasonably dry.
Because Steve and Amy, you always organise nice weather for us, don't you, on the front line walk? Pressure's on for this year.
We've been very lucky historically.
Yeah, can I just point out, Terry, you've now blown it for this year. Yeah.
You play this back now.
Hailing gales in Normandy. Yeah. But,
so we're going up to Crest Farm, which is Blendy.
Yeah, so then from Crest Farm, obviously the Canadians capture Crest Farm in October 17, and we then move round, come along the ridge line for a short distance, and then drop down so that we come in towards the back end of what, for many, is the highlight of day three, apart from the Menin Gate, of course, and that's Tynecott Cemetery, the largest of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries in the world, just under 12,000 buried in the cemetery, with 8,000 of them unknown, which reflects on what we were talking about with the state of the ground. And you've also got there the overflow from the Menin Gate, the memorial to the missing of the battles of Passchendaele, with 34,000 names on the memorial there. So the group can walk through. Those that want to take time, we allow plenty of time for them to wander through, find graves if they wish to, before moving on and following the old railway line, which runs all the way down to Zonnebeek and to what is now the location of the Passchendaele Memorial Museum, which is where we take lunch.
I think when we get to Zonnebeek and we sit in that beautiful gardens, in the gardens of the museum, that's when you start to feel you're reaching the end of the walk, isn't it? The atmosphere starts to lift. You feel very emotional because of all the stories that we've looked at along the walk. You're physically and mentally wrecked. But when you get to Zonnebeek, the finish line's in sight, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty much, although, you know, there's still got a way to go. It's not completely over yet. Leaving Zonnebeek after lunch, we move slightly uphill and across to a location known as Polygon Wood. Again, one of the most heavily fought over areas in the Battles of Passchendaele, the Third Passchendaele in 1917. But it's a real contrast because we've gone from open ground, walking on some roads, walking on tracks, to a pleasant stroll through what is now a beautiful wood.
It's a nature reserve.
It's a nature reserve. It's got a lovely walk through and, you know,
with all these pillboxes in
there. Yeah, there's lumps of concrete and stories that go with the concrete. But again, you know, the birds are singing, you've got the sun coming down through the trees. So it's a complete contrast to what it was like in 1917.
And then you've got the stunning cemetery, the Butts.
Yeah, you've got the Butts with the Australian Divisional Memorial and the New Zealand Memorial to the missing. A couple of really good stories, you know, the story of John Hunter, for example, who was found not too many years ago during some roadworks. But it allows the walkers to sort of, they're still going at their own pace, but it's a contrast to what they've been doing up to that point.
On the Tashendale Ridge. Yeah.
Then they're going to break out of there. They come past one of the iconic statues of the Western Front, the Black Watch soldier standing on his plinth with his bayonet fixed. So for the Scots members of the walk, it's quite
a very poignant
point. And then we move across, slightly cross country. It gets a little bit weird there because you get to see some of the rides at the Bellawada Fun Fair, which looks a bit...
Yeah, and you can hear it as well.
You can hear it. It looks a bit out of place. Mm. And then round via Hooga, or Hoos, through to Zillabeek Lakes. And it's at Zillabeek Lakes that we have the rally point. I get to tell the story of the guy who crashed his aircraft in the lake and, you know, that sort of thing. And then hopefully, with the bars open, they can grab a beer. If not, classic, have normally arranged a delivery.
Yeah.
And at that, from that rally point on, it's then just over a mile in through the Lille Gate into the city of Ypres and coming round through the Greater Mark and up Meninstrat into the Menin Gate.
So from Zillabeek Lake, the mile or so through the Lille Gate, it's a very different way that we walk, isn't it? What tell us, Steve or Amy, what happens when we form up at Zillabeek Lake? We're led in, aren't we?
We are led in. I've actually never seen it because I always run ahead to the Menin Gate to get the medals ready and get everything set up. But we are always led in by someone nominated by the walkers, whether that's a charity ambassador who's with us, someone who has particularly impressed everybody, or people who have struggled particularly and maybe walking a little bit slower.
So we get people that really struggled, we get them at the front, don't we? In twos.
Yeah, absolutely.
In twos,
walking along. So they set the pace, really. They go, as we said earlier, it's a group effort. Mm-hmm. So with the slowest walkers setting the pace, everybody finishes together, and it really hammers home just how much of a team event it really is.
And as we walk through that Grote Market, I feel funny now just talking about it. As we go through the Grote, people come at people that know the centre of Ypres, all the restaurants and bars, and people stop what they're doing and come out and applaud us, don't they? It's an incredible feeling. And then it ends there. And then we break off and go into our hotel rooms and get refreshed. And then we have a gala dinner, don't we, in the evening?
We do. It's always a fun occasion. It's a weird contrast, actually, from the finish line at the Menin Gate to then this celebratory dinner. But I do think it's important to celebrate what you've done. And
we do that in
Ypres. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the one thing that we also do is make sure that as a group we attend the Menin Gate ceremony that evening before going for the meal.
So do we lay a wreath at the Menin Gate? And if so, how does that work?
So yes, we do. We apply every year, and we're very lucky that every year it's been accepted. It tends to be the top three fundraisers every year who lay the wreath. And it's their place to kind of do what they want with. So Terry is normally one of the top fundraisers, and he will nominate someone from the walk to lay the wreath on his behalf.
Especially if we've got an ambassador there. I always like to see one of the ambassadors lay the wreath.
Yeah, it's a lovely moment.
And then, so the first day we go is a travelling day, and then on the Sunday we then travel back, everyone's a bit quiet, and then we all go our separate ways back to our normal lives until it comes again. So this year's Frontline Walk is in October. It's always in October. There are places left for this year's walk, but there's not a lot of time for people to raise the money. But you mentioned to me that next year's walk will be open soon.
Yeah, probably about August time. So if you just Google the Soldiers Charity Frontline Walk or go to soldierscharity.org/frontlinewalk, you'll see the website for this year, and you'll be able to sign up to a mailing list to hear when the 2023 walk opens. That's both Normandy and the Western Front.
Both the two walk. And in summary, I really encourage people to do this. I didn't know what I was letting myself in for when we started. It has been the most physically gruelling thing that I've ever done. but I've met some fantastic people along the way. You know, you really, and they're friends for life, really, aren't they? The people that we meet within in the community. And one other thing that's come out of it, as Amy said, we raised, was it £1.4 million since we started?
Yes, since 2014.
And then a couple of years ago, we produced a book, a souvenir book, about the Frontline Walk. And people can get a copy of that if they're interested through the Soldiers Charity shop, online shop. And that gives more details about some of the stories and the history of the battlefields that we've talked about in this podcast. So it's now, where are we now? June. So, oh blimey, I've only got 4 months in.
Better start training.
And as I said earlier, I was 48 when we started doing this. I'm 50. I'll be 58 by the time this comes around this year. And it does get harder every year, but we all drag each other along, don't we? So thank you very much for that, guys.
You're welcome.
And we'll report back after. We might even do a podcast, actually, while we're on the Frontline Walk. We can interview people as we're going along and see what they think then.
Get the difference between day one and day three.
Day one at the end of it, yeah. We might have to edit it a bit.
Can I suggest you interview somebody whilst they're in the foot clinic?
Yes. How does that feel?
Yeah.
We will do that. There'll be perhaps a couple of podcasts.
I'd be very glad that it's an audio podcast.
Not a visual one. Yeah, thank you very much. So one of those walkers that has joined us on the Frontline Walk is Judith Tetlow. And Judith's great uncle was a man called Eric William Lamont. And he was known as Eric, and he was a commissioned officer. He served with the 15th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers during the Battle of the Somme. But on the 14th of July 1916, he'd been attached to the 12th Battalion, and they were moving into Mametz Wood, ready for the attack on the Bazentin Ridge, which was to take place in the early hours of the 14th. But before he could take part in that battle with his regiment, he was killed, and he was probably killed by a shell. And there's a telegram in his file to say that he was killed in action on the 14th of July 1916 and was buried in the northeast corner of the Mametz Wood, a few miles northeast of Albert. So what that tells us is that Eric was still in the wood, because the wood has never been cleared of all of the bodies that fell during that battle. And he's one of the 72,000 that's remembered on the Tietvel Memorial. So there we were, many years later, and Judith is taking part in the Frontline Walk in October of 2021. And on the first day of the walk, just after our first break, we moved off and walked along the road that goes along the north side of Mametz Wood facing the Bazentin Ridge. And it was just inside this wood that we knew from the map reference in the officer's file that this is where Eric was probably still buried. So Judith went into the woods with her cross and a photograph of her dad, who had died just a few months before, and this was his uncle. And she paid her own respects. She spent some minutes in the wood before joining the walk. So to finish this podcast, we've had an interview with Judith, and she's explained what this experience of the Frontline Walk meant to not just her, but her family as well. So how did you get involved? When was it? How many walks have you done now?
So the first one I did was 2018. I'd seen information about it probably a couple of years prior to that, or two prior to that, and thought about doing it, wanted to do it, but it took me that long to sort of say, finally, right, I'm going to go and do it. The path that the walk took was what really interested me.
Was it?
And the fact that it went along the Somme, it went to Tietvel, and then, you know, the last day walking into Ypres. That all of that just really, really attracted me. It really drew me in. I wanted to go and do that.
And had you been to the Western Front before in any way?
I had, yes. So my siblings, I'm one of four, my siblings and I had taken my parents because we found out about a great uncle who on my dad's side, and he had started to research family history, but found out a bit more about this great uncle of mine.
And this was Eric Lamont.
This was, William Eric Lamont, known as Eric. And my dad was sort of fascinated by the whole thing. And so me and my siblings decided that we would take him over to France. We'd found out that he was remembered on Tikpal.
Yeah.
And we wanted to take him over there. So we took both my parents, me and my three other siblings, and off we went, loaded up in my brother's big vehicle, and off we went, and we went to Tikpal, and we drove around. We knew where Eric had died, and so we drove around the area. We looked at so many cemeteries, and because he doesn't have a marked grave, everywhere we looked there was a Northumberland Fusiliers.
You were looking for a potential grave, weren't you, for the Northumberland Fusiliers, and he was a second lieutenant in the 12th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers.
The Northumberland Fusiliers, yeah.
So that would have been his local regiment then, wouldn't it? He's joined his local regiment because Newcastle?
Yeah, from the northeast, yes.
Yeah.
So my family on my dad's side is all from up here. And so he went off. He'd joined up and gone over, and he was killed in Mamet's Wood. And
Just going through his service record that we've shared with each other in the past, we know from his service record that he was one of the first volunteers in September of 1914. He was 20 years old and he'd been a student, and he joined up as a private soldier with the Northumberland Fusiliers. But before he'd even gone abroad, he was commissioned, wasn't he? Applied for a commission in the spring of 1915, and he was granted a commission in June of 1915. And then he would have gone away for officer training somewhere in the UK. But in April 1916, he had a bit of a setback when he was sent home for a month because he had a nasal problem. We found out. But he quickly recovered from that. Within a month, he was pronounced fit again in May 1916. And of course, this is just in time for the Battle of the Somme, which, as we know, began on the 1st of July. And on the 14th of July 1916, the day before that, the Northumberland Fusiliers had moved up into Mamet's Wood to relieve the 38th Welsh Division that had suffered 4,000 casualties in the few days before in the taking of Mamet's Wood. And this was one of the most terrible experiences for any battalion during the Battle of the Somme. And it must have been in the early hours of the 14th of July 1916 that he was killed by shell fire, as a number of them were, as they prepared to go to the next stage. They were part of the 21st Division, and their plan was, in the early hours of the 14th, they were and they did attack the Bazentin Ridge as the next stage, having cleared Mamet's Wood. There was 11 men killed between the 11th and the 14th in Mamet's Wood, but he was the only officer in his unit to be killed on the 14th of July, and he's actually named in the battalion diary as one of three casualties, but the other two were wounded. He was the only one that was killed. And of those 11 that were died during those 3 days, nine of them have no known grave like him, but two of them are buried in Flatiron Copse, the cemetery just down the road where we stop on the first morning of the frontline walk. So it could be, if he does have a grave, it's most likely to be in Flatiron Copse, which, you've visited a couple of times now. And in all, during those few days in Mamet's Wood, as we know, there were three officers that were casualties. There were also 103 other ranks that were either killed, wounded, or missing. And they were all killed, we think, by artillery fire, because that's all that was going on. The Germans were shelling the wood. As I said, they'd relieved 38th Welsh Division, 4,000, just under 4,000 casualties. So what would have happened is, as they'd gone into the wood, from the side of the wood where the Welsh Dragon is now, they've moved up through the wood to get to their positions, almost 30 yards from the northern side of the wood, and they would have seen the dead and the dying of the Welshmen, not just the Welshmen, but the Prussian Guard that they were fighting against, because this battle had been taking place over the last two or three days. And I've got an account here which tells us what it looked like in Mamet's Wood on the day that your great uncle Eric died. And this was written by a Welsh officer called Captain Llewellyn Wyn Griffiths. And this is what he said: "I had to return to the ride. Years of neglect had turned the wood into a formidable barrier, a mile deep. Heavy shelling of the southern end had beaten down some of the young growth, but it had also thrown large branches into a barricade. equipment, ammunition, rolls of barbed wire, tins of food, gas helmets and rifles were lying about everywhere. There were more corpses than men, but there were worse sights than corpses. Limbs and mutilated trunks, here and there a detached head, forming splashes of red against the green leaves. And as in advertisement of the horror of our way of life and death, and of our crucifixion of youth, one tree held in its branches a leg with its torn flesh hanging down over a spray of leaf. I mean, looking back at it now for us, I mean, we walked through Lemets Wood, haven't we? And I was there a couple of weeks ago, and you just can't imagine it, can you? We can't imagine what it must have been like for those men. So what we found out from the battalion diary was that as the Northumberland Fusiliers and Eric moved into the wood, their front line was just 30 yards from the northern edge of the wood, along 30 yards from that road that we walked along last October. And there were still a few isolated groups of Germans, but they only offered half-hearted resistance because they knew that the number was up for them. And as I said, the wood was littered with the dead Welshmen and the Prussians. And when we went in October of last year, using some information that was in his service record, we were able to determine exactly where he was buried. And this is very unusual. I've looked through lots of service records, officer service records, and there's this memo dated the 14th of September 1916, so exactly 2 months to the day since he's died. And it says the military secretary presents his compliments to Mrs. Lamont and begs to inform her that a report has just been received from army headquarters in the field, which states that the late Second Lieutenant Lamont was buried in the northwest corner of the wood by the Mametz. And it even gives us the trench map reference. It goes on to say the military secretary ventures to send this information now, as Mrs. Lamont may not have previously received it. And as you explained to me, that he has no known grave. His grave wasn't found after the war, which is why he's one of 72,000 that are remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial. So when we were there last year, we got the linesman trench map device and we were walking along there, and then we found the spot really within about probably 10 or 15 yards, and off you went into the wood. And what happened then?
So it was, well, it was quite emotional and poignant actually to be there. I had a sort of photograph. I had the medals that he would have been awarded. Actually, there were replacement medals because my dad didn't have those, but through you, I found out how to get replacements. So I had those medals, and I had, you know, a photo of him, and I had a picture of my dad with me. My dad, who'd researched all of this, he sadly died in March last year. But I really wanted to go into the woods to that point to sort of just to bring the two together from that whole story and that whole history, and just to be in that place where Eric had died, and just to remember him and everybody really, because as you say, we cannot imagine what went on. We just can't. And
no,
it just seemed like the right thing to do, and it was a very special moment.
I think that the point for me was that when we researched, we went down to Kew and we managed to get Eric's file out, and we put it all together, and I know you presented it to your dad, didn't you? That was his birthday, wasn't it?
So yeah, so all of the work that you'd put together, the sort of the document with all of that extra information and some of the photographs that we'd had of Eric, and all of that sort of combination of all the information that you'd put into this wonderful document, I had printed up as a book essentially with a picture of him, but also a picture of Teat Vale on the front, and put it all together, and got the replacement medals, and my siblings and I gave that to my dad for his birthday present.
Wow.
And my dad was the most gentle, caring person I'm speechless at the whole thing now, but he was, just to see the reaction that he had to that and to see
uncle,
that book.
This was his uncle.
Who he'd obviously never known.
This was his dad's brother then, was it?
No, it was his mum's brother.
His mum's
brother, on his mother's side, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was so special for him to have that. And he spent so much time going through everything and reading the information and digesting it. And it was such a special moment for him to have that. But then for him to refer back to it so many times, and
really?
And he always mentioned it, and he always appreciated, he knew, you know, I talked to him about you, and I talked to him about how I'd met you on the walk, and he absolutely appreciated it so much. I can't even explain it. It really was something special. Yeah,
I think the reason why I wanted to talk to you about this is this it symbolizes for me what the Frontline Walk and the Soldiers Charity is all about, why we've done this over the years, because it brings to life these stories, doesn't it, when you can
absolutely
in the footsteps of your relatives. And in this case it was even more symbolic because this was late on in your dad's life, and it gave him some closure, didn't it, I suppose, and I helped probably helped him relate to his mum as well, because no doubt his mum often thought about what happened to her brother during World War One.
I think it explained an awful lot of the gaps that, you know, Dad had managed to find out some of the information. We had various bits of documents or photographs in the family, but it just pulled everything together for him. Yeah.
It was the service record, wasn't it? Telling us exactly where he was buried. And there was even the death telegram was in there as well, wasn't it? You know, that went back to the family, handwritten. And it was just so cold, isn't it? The telegram, the words in the telegram.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and when I looked through it today, you know, it really brought it back to me as well. So I felt emotional, you know, and it was not even my relative, so I can imagine how it felt. So I think that's wonderful. That is, and so when we went in October last year, it was just a few months after your dad had passed on, then, wasn't it? Which is why
it was
extra special to you.
It was very much, and of course, had it not been for COVID, I would have done that exact thing the previous year.
You
know, so it's all of those things, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And you were in the wood for some time, weren't you? I remember.
I was, yeah.
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 Lost in your own thoughts, because I remember you had your photo of your dad with you as well, didn't you?
Yeah, very much lost in my own thoughts. And it's as much as you say, it's a completely different place. There's still an atmosphere in that woods, definitely.
I can't describe it, you know. Of all the places I've been to on the Western Front, it's the only place that I feel uneasy when I go inside the Metzwood. Once I went in there on my own, and it was winter, so there wasn't many leaves on the trees, and the wind was rustling, and I came out. You know, it's the other side of the woods, the Welsh Memorial, and I came out of there, and you must have felt especially strange when you were in there, knowing that you were very close. He's probably still there, because although we said he might be in Flatiron Copse, it's unlikely, because so I understand that because you saw how thick that wood is, nature came back very, very quickly, and they probably never did clear the bodies from that wood. So those Welshmen and the Northumberland Fusiliers and those Prussian guards, they're probably all still in there, aren't they?
Very much.
And that's why it feels so eerie, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think you know that when you're there, and you know the scale of the destruction that went on. You can't imagine it yourself, but you know what happened.
It was over a course of a week. The Welsh went in on the 7th, and it was all over by the 14th. You know, when your great-uncle was there, that was the end of the Battle of Mametz Wood. They then moved on to the Bazantine Ridge and so on. So it was just over the course of a week, yet so many young men lost their lives there.
It is really amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
And so I think that was one of the first things that hit me going over to France and looking at is the number of the cemeteries and the battlefields when you're doing the walk. It's just constant, isn't it? Constant. Mm.
We talked today, I asked Amy what her most outstanding memory was, and she talked about the German cemetery, first one that we go to on day two, because it's dark, isn't it, when we're there.
Yeah.
And there's 40,000 of them there. So that's again, that's something that stuck with her. Oh, that's great. Thank you for that, Judith. Are you doing it again?
Not this year, although I'm doing another event for the Frontline Walk. So I did the first one we've talked about. The following year I did Normandy.
Yeah.
Then I went back to the Somme last year. I've done another challenge for the charity, and I'm doing another one again in February. And then who knows next autumn.
Didn't you and you went out to Africa, didn't you?
That's it, yeah. We were going to go and do the Sahara, but because of restrictions on travel, we couldn't do the Sahara. So we went to the Wadi Rum in Jordan instead, did 100 kilometres through the Wadi Rum. So in February, we are going to the Sahara to do 100 kilometres. Yeah, all for the soldiers' charity, yeah.
And when you came on the frontline walk that first time, did you know anybody?
No. I knew two people, but I didn't go on the walk. I happened to know them, through work connections and things.
Right.
But I, when I signed up for the walk, as far as I was concerned, I knew nobody.
Wow.
And met Helen, who you've referred to.
Yeah.
The first night when everybody meets in London, the night before the walk, and there's lots of messages on the groups. And she and I happened to be in the same hotel, met up to find our way to have pizza with everybody else.
Yeah.
And we've just walked together ever since. Yeah.
Well, you're like a couple of sisters, I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's
never
what you get from the walk. Never parted.
Yeah.
But that's what you get from the walk, isn't it?
You
just make these friendships.
That's right.
And it's everybody's there for a common aim, really. Mm, yeah.
That's right. That's what we talked about this afternoon. So I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. Slightly different to what we've done in the past, but lots of history in there, together with a shameless plug for the ABF Soldiers Charity and the Frontline Walk. There is still time to join up this year if you wish to, but not a lot of time to raise the money. But the walk, of course, will be going in October of 2023. Two walks, one across the Western Front and the other one along the Normandy and D-Day beaches. So finally today, I would like to pay tribute to all of the soldiers that we have paid our respects to during the frontline walk over the last 8 years, and in particular to 2nd Lieutenant William Eric Lamont, who was attached to the 12th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers and was killed in Mametz Wood in July 1916.